Welcome to Success Made to Last. I'm Tim Moore. This is the podcast that talks with people who live lives of excellence, brought to you by Blinkist, where you'll find thousands of nonfiction books condensed to 15 minutes, so you can test drive them or just browse them for the key ideas. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Today's guest is, in my view, the leading and finest conservative writer in the United States. Frankly, he should be at the top of the list of contemporary current events and culture writers, irrespective of political leaning. He went to the University of Texas, worked for newspapers in India and around the United States, has been a longtime columnist for the National Review, has written a handful of books, most notably The Politically Incorrect Guide to Socialism, The Dependency Agenda, The Smallest Minority, Independent Thinking in the Age of Mob Politics, and coming in October, Big White Ghetto, Dead Broke, Stone Cold Stupid, and High on Rage in the Dark Woolly Wilds of the Real America. Boy, I can't wait for that. He not only writes broadly on politics, culture, and history, he's a sometime book and theater critic as well. Last on the writing front, Kevin writes a fabulous newsletter on Tuesdays for a National Review Online about politics, culture, and language called, well, The Tuesday. Finally, Kevin and his colleague Charles Cook host a must-listen podcast called Mad Dogs and Englishmen. I listen to about 20 podcasts on a regular basis, but that's the only one I listen to every single episode of. So, Kevin, now that I've blown all that smoke up your skirt, thanks for coming.
Well, that's a very kind introduction. You know, I was just thinking to myself that the first thing that I thought when you asked me to do this is that I don't really actually think of myself as being all that successful, and I'm not sure that I really live the life of excellence that you're talking about, in the sense that I've done a lot of stuff that I'm happy with and make a good living and I've got a nice life and all that stuff. But I look at my work and my career and I see a lot of, you know, squandered opportunities and wasted time and mistakes and things like that. So we'll have a chance to balance out, I think, that very glowing introduction as our regular conversation proceeds.
Well, sometimes someone's success is in the eye of the beholder, and I don't, not to lay it on too thick, but your articles every week and your podcasts, you know, just have to be listened to and read. I used to publish books, Kevin, and this podcast is based on a book that an old friend of mine, Stuart Emery, and I. Stuart is an interesting character. One of the things he's famous for is He developed the original MasterCard priceless ad campaign, among other things. And we wrote a book called Success Built to Last. And in that book, which I read for recently again just to tune up, we interviewed about 300 people around the world, you know, the usual suspect billionaires, Steve Jobs and, you know, Richard Branson and, you know, famous people like world changers like Nelson Mandela, et cetera. But they all said, interestingly enough, that their life was filled with mistakes and failures. In fact, the mistakes and failures were the most important part of their life because they learned from them. I know that's become a cliche, but when the world's most successful people say that to you over and over again without prompting, there must be something to that. But Kevin,
did you ever read Megan McArdle's book on failure? It's called The Upside
Down. No, I haven't.
I will. Really good book on that very subject. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, not at all. I'm sorry. By the way, I'm supposed to be listening to you, so it's not an interruption. Kevin, I did hear recently though in a podcast, and I couldn't help but start off with this. Charles Cook said to you, "Are you feeling today Eisenhowerly or libertarianly?" And I want to know.
Yeah, well, I've been having more of an Eisenhower thing, I guess. You know, it's funny. I find myself my views and my political philosophy get less dogmatic and doctrinaire as I get older. I try not to think of conservatism as a kind of ideology, but as an escape from ideology, of a way of looking at the world, and libertarianism in a similar kind of way, although it's got a more naturally ideological flavor to it, I suppose. But as I get older and see more things and experience more things, I'm less and less inclined to see, you know, kind of obvious, self-evident, one-size-fits-all solutions for things. And, you know, there's this tendency, well, my first book was kind of about this, of libertarians to say, well, whatever the social problem is, free markets will take care of it, or charity will take care of it. And that's not really an answer, you know, you need a little bit more. So, but what I really liked about Eisenhower, and I've written about him a couple of times, I wrote a cover story about him for the National Review.
Yep.
Arguing the National Review was too hard on Eisenhower, because National Review was basically started to oppose Eisenhower and Eisenhowerism and a kind of more moderate strain of Republicanism. But I admire his modesty and the way he conducted himself as a person and in office. And I think that is something that we could use a great deal more of. You know, when he died, he was the highest ranking military officer since Grant. And he was buried in a standard issue pine box and tough medals and stuff on his chest and his field jacket. He knew he was going to be, you know, laying in state and all that stuff, and he wanted to send a particular kind of message. And Eisenhower was a guy who had this extraordinary life and went on to become president and do other things, but who really still lived a recognizable kind of life. He was a recognizably American person. He wasn't this you know, kind of insulated, isolated, class apart that we now see in politics.
Yes, and I think he wears better and better as the years go by. I think I happen to agree that he's one of the great presidents and certainly one of the great Americans. We could use a little bit of Eisenhower in the zeitgeist today, couldn't we?
Yeah, you know, just sort of some prudent, careful, cautious, hardworking grown-ups who are, you know, reasonably bright and patriotic and know what they don't know, know how to get advice and how not to get carried away with things. And, you know, the great thing about Eisenhower was that for his whole presidency, the American people just thought nothing was going on. It was the most boring time in American history. And it was just crisis after crisis after crisis, but he handled them in such a smooth and cool and rigorous way that people just thought he was playing golf balls.
Yeah, I've always juxtaposed him to another great American general, maybe even a more brilliant American general when all was said and done. That's Douglas MacArthur. But there's a kind of tortoise and hare-ness there, isn't there? I mean, MacArthur has to burn out because of who he is, and Eisenhower just keeps plugging along, doesn't he?
Well, you know, Eisenhower had a very disappointing career until World War II, and I think he was a major for 19 years or something like that, just because you couldn't get a promotion unless, you know, you were in combat, essentially. This is the way things were done at the time. And so he was used to frustration, used to disappointment, used to taking things slow and pursuing things in a steady and methodical kind of way.
Yes, yes, indeed. Kevin, as I mentioned, this is a podcast that, you know, focuses on people whose lives are emblematic, at least we think they are, of a phrase, success made the last. I'd like to go back to, you know, the way you go back in the way back machine, Mr. Peabody, and talk about your youth. You know, you were born in Lubbock, Texas, and, you know, that's a place even today that's a long way away from somewhere, isn't it? And
well, I don't actually know where I was born, but my first year of my life was spent in Amarillo, so I was adopted, and in the 70s, you know, adoptions were still much more secretive than they are now.
Yes.
So
yes,
I have no idea.
Yes.
I know where my adoption was handled and my birth certificate is issued by Potter County there in Amarillo, but I suppose I was probably born somewhere around there. But we moved to Lubbock before I was a year old, so Lubbock was essentially all I knew.
Well, Amarillo, Lubbock, they're both pretty far from anything, Kevin.
they're not radically different from one another. You know, the Lubbock-Amarillo rivalry thing is hilarious because, you know, it's the two cities hate each other, and they're remarkably alike, and neither one of them, as you point out, very close to anything else.
Well, Lubbock, as you may know, as a person who grew up there, though, was the sort of the music capital of Texas before Austin was. I mean, people like Buddy Holly and Roy Orbison and Joe Ely and the Flatlanders and Lloyd Maines and Delbert McClinton, and I could go on for a while, but that was quite a scene.
Yeah, I went to high school with Natalie Maines and the Dixie Chicks.
I don't really have
any memory of her. She was 2 years behind me, I guess, so she would have been a sophomore when I was a senior. So I didn't really know her. I actually knew her dad a little bit. But, I spent a lot of time watching Joe Ely sing and Jimmy Dale Gilmore and those folks. I knew Peggy Sue Guerin a little bit. I bet him famous song.
Oh, really?
She's kind of kind of a fixture around town. So, yeah, Lubbock was a great place for music. And I played music when I was young. Punk bands and stuff like that. Nothing terribly exciting. You know, Charlie Cook, my podcasting partner, was like a touring rock and roll musician at one point. I was not a touring rock and roll musician unless you count going from my garage to my friend's garage.
Well, what was it like? I mean, what were your goals? I mean, did you have goals? What were your influences? What did you dream about? I mean, we all dream about something, and some of us, you know, actually have those dreams at a young age, and some of us don't have them until we're older. You know, I probably didn't find what I was really meant to do until I was 40-something, and that was published books, and still doing that because podcasting is publishing, isn't it? But tell me about your early life and how it formed you.
Well, for the first 18 years of my life, my overriding concern was escape. So I came from a pretty unhappy family. They probably should not have been allowed to adopt children. They didn't have too primitive standards for that sort of thing, I guess, back then. So, you know, my mother had a series of dysfunctional, alcoholic, et cetera, husbands. A lot of police visits to the home, that sort of thing. A lot of going to pick stepdads up out of jail and kind of good stuff. So that was not a super happy time. I was lucky, though, in that Lubbock is a college town. Texas Tech is there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's a college town that doesn't have a lot of private schools. So there's pretty high demand for high-quality public education there. So both because of, Lubbock's a big enough city, back then it was about 200,000 people. I guess it's around 250,000 people now. It's a big enough city to be an actual city, but it's small enough that you don't have a lot of social distance between people, or physical distance between people, for that matter. You know, you tend to live and go to school with people who are from different backgrounds from your own. So people I went to school with, I had some really very good teachers. I had some really very good classmates and their families who kind of helped me to see what was possible in life and to give myself some ideas about how to pursue that. Starting in seventh grade, I guess, I was part of a magnet program. Lubbock had a really good one at the time. I guess it still probably does. And then I went to a pretty extraordinary high school, Lubbock High School there. And went to school with just an extraordinary group of people who have done all sorts of interesting things since then. There were something like 40 National Merit Scholars in my graduating class.
Really?
Yeah, we had just a heck of a chess team. We couldn't win a football game to save our lives, but we were the worst football team in 5A history. Literally, we went 0-10 for years and years and years and years and years.
Oh,
and
wow.
We had a pretty good wrestling team. I was a wrestler. So about seventh grade, though, I kind of really discovered that I liked writing. Well, I guess I was writing a little bit before that, but it sort of dawned on me that it might be something I could do. It might be something I could do professionally. And that was really right about the time I started discovering National Review and things like that, too. I guess National Review or Discovery Next Year when I was in eighth grade. And, journalism as an occupation is a way of writing for a living without, I'm going to move to New York and be poor and write a novel and hope that it sells a million copies and then go be Ernest Hemingway, which kind of would have been fun if it worked out. But that's not the route I chose. So journalism looked like an occupation, it was something that I could do and enjoy. I remember when I was in seventh grade, we had one of these stupid seventh grade assignments where you basically had to go out into a field and collect insects and make a little insect collection and, you know, write about, you know, classify all the insects and all this kind of stuff. And it was just a dumb, annoying assignment. I didn't really want to do it, but I had a good teacher and I liked her a lot, and I didn't want to just, you know, completely blow it off. So I wrote this report that was a parody of a Hemingway hunting story. And I was kind of reading those at the time. And now, I don't think it was great literature, but it's pretty good for maybe being 12 or 13 or however old I was at the time. And she responded to it pretty positively. And although I had actually done the work too, I was pretty conscientious about that sort of thing. And, you know, when you're good at school, but not much else and don't have much else in your life, you tend to spend a lot of effort on being good at school and to enjoy it. So I wrote a piece the next year when I was in eighth grade that ended up getting published in a Houghton Mifflin textbook, I guess, which was my first kind of first publication. And yeah, one of my teachers had submitted, you know, back in the 80s when they wanted to make things relevant, so they would take student writing and that kind of thing. And they sent me as my payment, it's very nice, I still have it around here somewhere, dictionary and thesaurus set with, you know, my name embossed on the front. Anyway, the dictionary, though, has an introduction written by William F. Buckley. And so I got to tell Bill about that, but the first thing I ever got paid with was kind of actually how I first encountered him.
Wow, that is something. You went from Lubbock to UT here in Austin, and...
Yeah, it was a mistake.
You say that in that podcast that or lecture I'll refer to later on, but that you did, I guess, at Ohio University. But talk about that. I mean, at some level, it must have been a great experience, though, because you're going to a bigger city and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Although Austin in 91 or 2 when you went is a different place than it is today. But talk about the mistake or whatever happened there.
Well, I had a good time. no complaints there. You know, being an English major at the University of Texas, I think, was just not a very good education in a lot of ways. My English classes mostly were pretty good, and I had a couple of very, very good classes, especially those taught by a professor named Adam Zachary Newton, who I had for Victorian Lit, and then a class in novels of Thomas Conrad and Joseph Conrad and Thomas Hardy, sorry. That was a long semester. There's a lot of Hardy. I liked Conrad a lot better. Most of what I had to do at university was, I've been talking to Charlie too much, so I say at university, like I'm an Englishman. And most of it was a waste of time. You know, my Latin classes were useful. I had a couple of classes outside of the English department that might have been good. But the real value I got from UT was working at the newspaper, which at the time, the Daily Texan was the sixth largest daily newspaper in Texas by circulation. And when I was the managing editor there, you know, I was 21 years old. And I had 121 employees and a budget of $2.5 million. And I was running the sixth largest daily newspaper in Texas. So that was tremendously fun, and that's the sort of thing you get to do when you go to a big school like that. You know, you had almost, I think, 50,000 students at the time, if you counted the grad students and law school and all that. And so it was a sizable community on its own, and that was tremendously fun. So if I had maybe instead gone to work for the Wall Street Journal and taken a couple of classes in my spare time, it probably would have been a better education. And, of course, I didn't finish at UT. I left to go work in India. And then when I went back some years later to check in to see where I needed to finish my degree, they were telling me, well, most of the things you could do, you know, we can kind of finesse this or that. You can probably take a test for this. But we really need you to take the undergraduate writing seminar. And I said, I don't think I need to take the undergraduate writing seminar. And then a couple of years later, I checked back in again. It was the same deal. Well, you've got to come back and take the undergraduate writing seminar. And by that point, I'd been teaching undergraduate writing at King's College in New York, and I had taught it at a seminar. And I said, can I get you a note, you know, from my book publisher, my agent, Bill Buckley, the editor of National Review, I don't know, the Washington Post, and says I can write. And you can go to my Amazon page. So I still need to take the undergraduate writing seminar at the University of Texas, apparently. So maybe I'll do that one.
Okay. Well, leave it to academics to be obtuse.
Yeah.
that's a great story. I had no idea of any of that. You go to Mumbai, excuse me, and
still calling Bombay back then.
Yes, it was called Bombay back then, and as you mentioned, in the smallest minority, there were lots of monkeys there who slung poo. But that was
Delhi.
Was that Delhi?
Okay. The big monkey temple's in Delhi.
Okay, that's in Delhi. But tell me, how did you get a job in India?
Well, I like that because I'm so smart and charming. But in truth, what happened was I had a friend in college whose family lived there in Bombay, and they were business people there. And his grandmother had been in politics, so she knew a lot of journalists and things like that. And they were able to arrange for me to take a position through their family connections. So the funny thing, of course, is that it's probably still this way, but in the 90s, it was just categorically illegal for a foreigner to work in the press in India in an editorial capacity.
Oh, really?
So I was an illegal, I was an illegal immigrant. Partly it was a nationalist and security thing, but mostly it was a union thing. You know, they didn't want to have competition in labor unions there. So I got paid every 2 weeks in this great big bundle of cash, which wasn't a lot of money, but at the time, the biggest note they had in circulation was 500 rupees, which would have been about 16 bucks or something like that. So this kid would come down from the office with basically, you know, a grocery bag full of cash for me. And I would take that home. And so they called me a consultant, I think was the deal. But basically, I was an illegal immigrant. And I worked there for over a year, I guess. And I still write for the Indian Press every now and then. I'll do a piece for them or for another newspaper once in a while. It was tremendously fun. I really enjoyed it. It made India, especially in the 90s, was just a great place to be a newspaper guy because people really follow the papers there. You know, every educated household get 3, 4, 5 newspapers a day. And it really mattered there in a way that it probably doesn't in the United States much anymore. So it was kind of like maybe what it would have been like working for an American newspaper between the middle of the 19th and the middle of the 20th century, where you were really, you know, kind of the voice of the news. And that was fun. I got to know Raj Kamal Jha, who went on to become a very famous novelist. He was my editor at the time. He's the deputy editor at the paper. I guess he's the editor-in-chief now. He wrote The Blue Bedspread and If You're Afraid of Flying and some other books like that. He's a tremendous writer. Mm-hmm. In fact, I got to see his first novel when he was just sort of scribbling it out in a longhand in a spiral notebook because he has insomnia and he doesn't sleep well. So he would just go home and write, and he showed me these stories one day and asked me if I thought they were any good, and I thought they were pretty good. And they ended up becoming the book that made him, I guess he was the highest paid debut novelist in the history of India. And I think, did he win the Man Booker Prize, or he was nominated for the Man Booker Prize or something like that?
I think he was at least nominated. I don't know for sure.
Tremendous book. Tremendous book. And a brilliant guy. So that was fun. And I really, you know, I was in my 20s, and I'd never really been out of the country before, except for, you know, Mexican border towns and that sort of thing. So, that was a great experience. And in retrospect, I might should have stayed a little longer.
Yeah, it must have been a great experience, as you say, to have existed in a newspaper world that was like the one of the 40s and 50s, perhaps in the United States, you know, the old Studs Terkel and kind of world, right?
Well, the great thing about it was that I was kind of, at the time, I was sort of a technology guy in the sense that I had managed the transition to Quark Express, which was a new thing back then, and desktop publishing in Austin at the Daily Texan. And big papers like The Express in India and the New York Times back in the States were just getting started doing that. So, you know, they hired me originally because I was a friend of a friend and, like, give this idiot American a job. Then after I was there for a couple of days, they figured I was useful. And so they actually kind of let me be in charge of some stuff. And that was a really, really great opportunity for someone that age in that situation.
Fabulous opportunity. Really fabulous opportunity. When you return home, Kevin, you worked for a bunch of daily newspapers around the country.
Yeah.
And also at George Mason and other places in sort of an academic role. Were you consciously, or was it serendipitously, that you were building what we like to call a portfolio of skills, you know, daily journalism juxtaposed with a more reflective mode of academia? Was that intentional or just serendipitous?
No, not in the least. So I ended up at the Institute for Humane Studies, which is at George Mason University, because I had been involved in studying a newspaper in Philadelphia, which seemed like a good idea at the time, you know, but that was just a spectacular business failure. And after they could no longer afford to pay me, and they very politely fired me one morning. I already get fired at breakfast for some reason. Both the Philadelphia Bulletin and the Atlantic both fired me at breakfast.
Promise not to mention the Atlantic now, Kevin.
if Rich Lowry ever asked me to have breakfast with him, no, I'm not going. But after the failure of the newspaper in Philadelphia, I moved to a very, very small town in Colorado, in northwestern Colorado, and helped run a newspaper out there for a while. So I was editing that newspaper. And it wasn't a place I was going to stay forever. So I kind of got them up to where they needed to be and recruited a good replacement for myself, and then tried to went on to the next thing. I've been planning to go back to school. And in fact, I was going to go to Rome and enroll in a graduate program there where I could also finish up my undergraduate work while I was doing my graduate work. And that ended up not happening for financial reasons and personal reasons. And so I was back in Lubbock, Texas, working on the copy desk at the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, where I had been some years before that when I was a youngster. So at that point, I guess I'd been editor-in-chief of three newspapers, and I was working on the copy desk. And I don't know whatever they were paying me, $12 an hour or something like that. So that was not a great time for me professionally. Then I got the job at the Institute for Human Studies at George Mason. So the move from Lubbock to Washington, I didn't have the money to move really. Kind of basically just in the car for a couple of days, and then I settled into rental there in Virginia, where I was actually the only time in my life I ever shared a house with people, except for being married. And that was not a big deal. But it was a pretty good job, and I was able to get myself sorted out financially pretty quickly, I think. And then I was there for just about 1 year. I didn't spend a lot of time there. And National Review called me up looking for a recommendation for a deputy managing editor. And I chained my way into the job. I recommended myself and moved up to New York.
When was that, Kevin? I mean, it just seems to me, in my memory, you've been there forever, but I know you haven't. When did you come to?
I started at National Review in January of 2008. So I've been there.
Is it really that late? So it's only been 12 years.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
And for the first 2 years, I was a deputy managing editor, so I wasn't doing just a lot of writing. In fact, it's funny, when they interviewed me for the job, you know, we need just a lot of editors there because we have so much copy that goes through. And Catherine Lopez told me three times in the interview, you know, remember, this isn't a writing job. You probably don't need to do very much writing. And are you sure you're okay with that? I was like, yeah, I'm sure I'm fine with that. Because I love National Review. I applied for a job there when I was in high school. I got a very nice note back from Bill and one from John O'Sullivan. I'm not currently in need of your services, even though you are the editor of the Lubbock High School newspaper. But National Review was a place to be. And it was great to eventually be able to land there. And I've been there ever since, except for that short period when I wasn't.
You know, I know that everybody asks this question, but it's obligatory at some level. And that is, you know, what was your experience with Lynn F. Buckley Jr.? Like, I can still remember watching in the 60s, late at night on Channel 13 in New York, which was the PBS station, I think on Friday or Saturday nights. But, it's like something like midnight, in black and white, of course, all those firing lines. And there was this guy on the show, and he had this funny kind of accent, really. And And he seemed to have read everything that was ever written, and he seemed to have remembered it, even more importantly. Fascinating. I mean, as a kid watching that, it was breathtaking to me. It still is. I mean, because, you know, it's, well, it's breathtaking. What was your experience like with him? He must have been an extraordinary human being to be around.
Yeah, well, remember, he died shortly after I started National Review, so I
That's
didn't
true.
Spend a lot
right.
of time with him. I'd actually met him a couple of times briefly before I went to work for an hour. I kind of made a point of it. He did have me and some of the other editors over to dinner maybe 3-4 months before he passed away, which was only the only time I really spent very much time with him
evening.
So he asked me for a vocabulary word. That was pretty good. He was telling a story about something, and he said, and I won't try to do Bill's accent, but he said, you know, his prose style, it was kind of, what's it mean? It means like engraved in stone. I said, lapidary? Yeah, lapidary. And I went home and wrote a letter to one of my high school English teachers saying that, job well done. I just supplied a vocabulary word to Bill Buckley. So he was great. He was brilliant, you know, gracious, a really good guy. He was quite old at that point, and he was physically pretty well beaten down. I think he had a broken wrist at that point. Mentally, still quite there, although tired, I think. And he had various, you know, other health concerns, and had recently lost his wife, and was not, I think, probably personally, emotionally in a super great place. Well, and he was, as he said in an interview, I guess, with Charlie Rose, just frankly ready to die. Was kind of, you know, he thought his work was done, and he was still writing, of course, up until the end, but he was ready to go. But Bill was a huge influence on me, as he was for a lot of people, long before I ever knew him or had the chance to meet him. You know, he was a particular kind of writer who gave me an idea when I was young of a way in which I could do that. You know, writing journalism, writing opinion pieces, although I didn't really start doing that until later. You know, seemed like a thing that could be done. It wasn't like saying, I'm going to go be a rock star, I'm going to be William Shakespeare. It's, you know, I'm going to write a syndicated column, do some journalism, do magazine articles, and that kind of thing. And I had sort of a long detour before that as a newspaper manager, which is what I did most of my 20s and early 30s. But, you know, I'd write a column on the side kind of when I could sneak it in. So, no, but Bill was tremendously inspirational, and even though I didn't really spend a lot of time with him, you know, his imprint is still very strongly on the culture and the people of National Review. And I'm, you know, one of my dearest friends in this life is Jay Northenberg from National Review, and Jay and Bill were very, very close personal friends. And so I sort of, you know, get a little of it through Jay as a kind of avenue of transmission.
Yeah, I'm a magnificent person, a real polymath too. I mean, I don't know if you've read his mysteries, but they're very good, very enjoyable.
Yeah,
I think I've read almost all of them.
Yeah, my favorite of his novels isn't one of the Blackford Oaks. It's Elvis in the Morning, which I think is a really wonderful book. But yeah, I think I suppose I probably read all the books that he published, which were a lot.
Yes, I seem to write all the time. Kevin, speaking of writing all the time, I mean, I think you write 3 columns a week for the online version of the magazine. You write, is it really that many? My goodness, I know it's a lot. I read every week, and
I publish something just about every day.
Yeah, I get to see it every day, and every day I see your name. It gets printed out for reading that night, and you do an article, a longer article for every magazine, which is roughly every 2 weeks, and.
Yep.
And you're writing books. I guess you love writing. What is it? You know, I have a couple.
Also, write a column for the New York Post.
Yeah, and the Post. That's right. Excuse me, which you called recently the indispensable newspaper, and I think you're right. By the way,
newspaper.
But I have a couple of friends who are writers, and you know, all novelists. In fact, one of both of them are very good novelists. One of them wrote one of my favorite books ever written, called Comanche Dawn, and. Yeah, it's a history in novel form of the rise of the Comanches. And it, by the way, Kevin, it's a fabulous book. His name is Mike Blakely. But in any case, what is it that you love about writing? Because every writer has a little different take on that.
Yeah. Let me put it this way. I also write music badly. I like music. I care a lot about music. I enjoy it. I used to spend a lot of time writing music. I was never any good at it, but it's just something I kind of like to do. Just like some people like to paint, even though they know they're not very good painters. When I was doing music, mostly what I would do is just sort of produce stuff that I would enjoy. Kind of stuff that I like listening to. So if I wanted to do a song for, two pianos and sitar, I'd do a song for two pianos and sitar. And it wasn't like I was going to try to sell it or anything. And so I kind of write the same way. I really write for myself. I write stuff that I am interested in, and I try to write it in a way that's enjoyable to you and on the theory that other people may enjoy it as well. So I'm super lucky in the sense that I've got this open portfolio at National Review where I can basically just go wherever I want, write about whatever I want. And as long as I'm writing a lot, they're happy with, me to pick my own things. Every now and then allows me to do something, but mostly I get, sort of free rein to do what I like. And I have some people in mind when I write. I think about, people like Jay or Brooke Heiser or George Will or some other people who are friends, who are readers. And I'm proud of the people who read me. It's not a huge audience, but it's an audience that's got some people in it. And so I try to write for them. Writing the sort of writing I do, one of the things I hate about American journalism is this excruciatingly boring, proper voice that everybody has to hear. It's New York Times. We are the New York Times. Yes, the New York kind of voice. Because they write that way because that's taken as a shorthand for intellectual seriousness. That if you're smart, this is how you write. It reads, in this very flat kind of way. But if you're trying to walk people through the federal budget or, the situation with opiate addiction or poverty in Appalachia or any of the stuff that I write about, you need to give them a little something every couple of paragraphs to be worth the effort. So I try to, include something that's going to be, fun to read and enjoyable. I was a huge Tom Wolfe fan. I got to know him a little bit too from being an instrument.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Great writer. Oh, my God.
But yeah, just such a delight to read. And I think that often is what's missing. American political writers are really about the politics and not about the writing. And they don't pay enough attention to their prose, I think. Whereas I'm the other kind, I think. I'm a writer who works in politics, but I could be just as happy writing novels or plays or other sorts of things. So for me, the actual work of doing the writing is it. And I was thinking about that earlier too. And as I mentioned, I don't really ever think about, am I successful? Am I not successful in abstract terms like that very much? And to the extent that I do, I often think not so. But the nice thing about what I do is you've always got something to work on. You've got the thing in front of you to concentrate on. And if you do well on that, and you feel like you've done pretty well. And so every now and then, maybe one piece out of 30, I'll finish up and go, yeah, that was fun. I really like doing that one. And that's a good piece. I'll put that in the file for the greatest hits. And the other 29 are the things you just have to do to get there, to do that. I mean, partly it's, a financial thing. You could write every day if you're in my business and you got to put out a copy to make a living. But partly it's also, if I'm not writing something that's, a B or B minus, that doesn't mean that I'm going to be writing something that's an A plus instead. It means I'm just probably not going to be doing anything. The A plus stuff is going to come when it comes, when it's a good story and things come together well. And then you've just got a lot of time to fill up in between. So why not do some reasonably good work with that, rest of your life rather than just trying to sit it out and not do anything. I mean, I suppose if you're, some people who are really, really very good, and better at figuring out how to get paid for this stuff than I am. Maybe they just do that, the A-plus work, and then take off the rest of the time and do it. But, I like to read, I like to write, I like to have conversations about this kind of stuff. So, as I often tell people, if I weren't getting paid to do what I do, I'd still want to do it. Now I'm glad I get paid for it. And it's nice that works out that way. But, it doesn't really feel like work. It's, most of the time it doesn't feel like work. Every now and then it feels like work. But, it's enjoyable. I'm a little bit of a graphoman, I suppose. I write a lot more than I publish. I've got, you know, drawers and drawers and files full of stuff that's never seen the light of day and probably never will. Charlie and I figured out this one day that I must write something on the order of right around 1 million words a year, something like that.
Hmm. That's like Stephen King.
Yeah, one of the great insults ever, I remember someone described Stephen King as the horror typist.
You know, it's funny about him. He's written about 70 books, and only about 18 of them are horror stories. And frankly, those are his least successful books, but I digress, don't I? You know, you said something that, this is about the third time in the conversation, you said something that when we interviewed those 300 people, constantly was said, and that is, I would still be doing this whether I got paid for it or not. And that's the thing that obviously that gives you meaning, and it's the cause, if you will, you know, air quotes, that makes you wake up in the morning. I think, you know, the other thing I think is too many people in the world, academics, journalists, and others, historians, that think that obfuscation is erudition. And instead of you know, understanding that if you want to move someone from point A to point B in their understanding of something, it has to be entertaining at some level. After all, I think it was Aristotle who said that, you know, enlightenment comes from, you know, entertainment, and or words to that effect. And I spoke this morning to H.W. Brands, the great American historian. And, you know, he's just a great writer. I mean, I just read his most recent book, Dreams of El Dorado. And, reading it was like rereading. Almost an analog, a nonfiction analog to Lonesome Dove. That's what writing is, real writing is about, it seems to me. So I'm glad to hear you talk about that. Hey, for everybody out in podcast land, Kevin, talk a little bit about the smallest minority. It's a cry in the wilderness at some level for people to reclaim or maybe claim for the first time their individuality and stop, you know, borging with the mob. And it's especially important, I think, in this day and age where it seems like the mob is synonymous with, you know, our fellow Americans. Riff on that book for those who haven't read it. And by the way, it's highly entertaining and readable, as everything else you do is.
Oh, thanks. You know, that monkey story that you referred to there at the beginning, and is there because I had to switch out the original opening, which, so this book is by far the most profane and vulgar and profanity-filled book that Regner has ever published, but my opening paragraph was too much, apparently, so that was one part of the book that I really had to change. So we got the monkey story instead of the original version, which I'll recycle and use somewhere else sometime. This book is about the phenomenon of, you know, what we sometimes call Twitter mobs, these, you know, social media hate sessions that have become a part of our life. And I had started writing this book. I had written a proposal for it maybe 2 years before I went to work for The Atlantic, and nobody wanted it. So I just sat there, and if I don't get paid, I don't do the work. So I just let it sit there. And the day I got fired, my phone rang, we want this book, please write it. And that came together after that. So the thesis of the book essentially is that there are a lot of things that used to give people a sense of belonging, status, meaning, connection in life, to help them situate themselves and their lives in a kind of, you know, moral and ethical human universe and community, which sounds very highfalutin. So people had marriage, family, church, children, those sorts of things. People didn't move very much. They had long ties to the local community. They had jobs for a long period of time. You know, my father, since they worked for two companies all of his life, you know, 20 years at one and 20 years at the other, which is pretty normal for men who finished high school in 1957 when he did. And a lot of those things have been diminished or taken away, or at least attenuated. So we get married later in life than we used to. Fewer of us get married at all. We have children later in life than we used to. We have fewer children, and more of us don't have any children. We don't go to church as much. We aren't conventional religious believers. Americans don't move as much for work as you might expect, but the American kind of upper class that sets the cultural tone is really very mobile and moves a lot. So a lot of these things that used to give us a sense of who we are and how we relate to other people have gone away from our lives, and we've gone looking for new sources of meaning and status and belonging. And a lot of us, for whatever reason, have settled on this particularly dumb, illiterate form of political partisanship. You know, the idea of my team good, your team bad. This really kind of rank, old-fashioned primitive tribalism, readapted for a world of social media and the strange partisanship at the moment. Somebody at Vox, I always forget her name, I've credited to her there before, the really good observation about this, that the paradox of our time is we have very strong partisanship while we have very weak political parties. So we've seen this, kind of online mob overwhelm institutions like parties and universities and newspapers and magazines. That, my riff on this used to be that I admire the New York Times for standing up for itself, which it did for a long time. It doesn't anymore. You know, for years there were campaigns to get rid of people like, Bret Stephens and Barry Weiss. And then, of course, Barry Weiss left and they fired their op-ed editor and that kind of stuff. So they're not quite standing up for themselves as much as they used to. So part of the book is about why we got into the situation and what the cultural trends are. And then part of it is what it means for our politics, which is that it's really very difficult for people to be good citizens if they can't interact with one another as anything other than mascots and totems of opposing, rival, or even warring social tribes. So there's no way to come to policy consensus. There's no way to achieve sort of bipartisanship. And to have stable government, and particularly a stable parties, stable policy environment, you really need those things. You have to have basically consensus policies, because if you don't have wide democratic buy-in in a system where you've got elections every 2 years, then things will always be up in the air. And that's what we're seeing right now. I mean, the great example of that, I think, is the Affordable Care Act, where, the Democrats had this unprecedented position of power after the election. They had the White House, and, well, not unprecedented, but unusual White House and both houses of Congress, and this inspirational new president, Barack Obama. They'd always wanted to do something with health care. And so they marched through this thing about which there is no real agreement, no real consensus. And the idea is we just pass it, get it into law, and we'll work out the details later. And when you do something like that, what you do is you just create a new opportunity for an ongoing fight. So irrespective of what you think about the Affordable Care Act, whether it's good policy or bad policy, the way it was passed, the politics behind it, ensured that it was never actually implemented. And there were things that the Democrats didn't want to see implemented and didn't, like the Cadillac tax and some of the other unpopular bits of the bill, things the Republicans didn't want to see implemented and wanted to see repealed, which they also have been successful in blocking and repealing to some extent. And so now we've got this big landmark once-in-a-generation bill that was passed that has created a policy environment which is completely unstable, unknowable. No one knows what it's going to be like 6 months from now or a year from now. And we do the same thing with taxes. We do the same thing with other kinds of regulations, things like the Waters United States Act. And this is a particularly American way of doing things. If you look at some other countries, I always use the case of Switzerland because I like Switzerland. I'm always looking for an excuse to visit. But also, I think it's probably the best governed country in the world, where it's really difficult to get anything done without really wide democratic buy-in. Unless 70% of the population, 75% of the population supports it, it's really hard to make a big change to Swiss policy. And if you've got, 10 or 15% of the population that really, really strongly opposes something, even then it can be very difficult to get it done. So when they do make a big change, it's because there's really wide general agreement about it. The people have kind of worked out the compromise that everyone can live with. And so they've got a really very stable policy environment. That brings all sorts of political, economic, and social benefits, whereas the instability we have imposes all sorts of political, economic, and social costs. So that's pretty much that book. And it was fun to write. And, as you've read the book, 3/4 of the book is a normal kind of political book, and about 1/4 are these footnotes that run along at the bottom where I kind of let my id vent throughout.
It's a lot of fun. I mean, it's hard to believe that you can say that about a political book. And maybe it's not a political book at some level, because you really are you really are championing the notion, you know, it's a very, very old notion, West, of the individual and the really responsibility of an individual to, act like one. It's a lot of fun. And it's a great book. And Kevin, I don't want to keep you all day, but I do want to ask you about your coming book. I mean, my God, what a title, Kevin. I mean, it sounds like there's more, even more it in this one. I mean, let's read it again just for, well, as they say in the streets, shits and giggles. Big White Ghetto. Dead broke, stone cold, stupid, and high on rage in the dark, woolly wilds of the real America. Holy mackerel. What is that going to be about?
It's dank, woolly wilds of the real America, not dark. But So this book is a collection of long, in-depth reported pieces that I've done for National Review over the years, having to do with mostly things like poverty, addiction, various kinds of underclass dysfunction, things like that. So there's, you know, my stuff from Eastern Kentucky, the reporting about the heroin and opioid situation, interviews with everything from, you know, I'm trying to remember. I think the Richard Spencer interview is in there. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it is.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, reporting from alt-right rallies and people fighting about Confederate statues and things like that. So there's this whole, you know, kind of piece of America that you don't really get if you work for the New York Times, you work for the Washington Post, and you don't travel and talk to people and kind of know about that world a little bit. And I kind of come from that world, that, you know, sort of white underclass dysfunction. So it's something I know a little bit about. And, so, you know, I did a thing where I went and visited every bankrupt city in California, and all the California cities are going bankrupt, and actually in San Bernardino from when they declared their bankruptcy, and, you know, kind of talk to people and write about what I didn't see and what their lives are like and all that. So there's a lot of, you know, kind of gritty first person stuff in there that is not just, you know, kind of political pontification, which I think is the least interesting thing I do. But the more interesting thing I do, I think, is the reporting. And so this is some of the best of that, I think. Organized.
Well, that sounds fabulous. You know, I read the title, I thought to myself, I wonder if he's going to talk about the same kinds of things that Murray talks about in Coming Apart and Vance talks about in, I can't remember the title of that one, so, but it doesn't matter. Because, yes, thank you. Because there's, you know, Murray tells the story so well. I mean, there's this, the same dysfunction that we all talk about constantly in the urban parts of America has now taken, you know, root deeply in the white parts of America. Things like high instances of drug addiction, high instances of single parenthood, and you know, the rest of society, the majority society, if you will, is coming apart. So I'm looking forward to that in a grim sort of way, but I think that's, you know, it's an important thing to talk about. Kevin, maybe we'll reach out to you. I think your book is coming out in October. Am I right about that, or is it more close than that?
October the 27th.
Of October. Maybe we'll reach out to you then and have an extended conversation if I haven't bored you too badly in this conversation. But I it's a great pleasure, really. I've enjoyed your work. It's a fabulous. One of the things about these podcasts is talking to people that have brought, you know, I guess the best word is joy, even though, you know, it's sometimes about grim subjects. So I want to thank you very much for the time and for the constant flow of good things to think about. I even find that when I read you, it's true. And then, I don't agree with you all the time, and that's not the point of reading somebody like you. But I always have to ask myself, what do you really think, Tim, about this? You know, is Kevin right or are you right? By the way, I agree with about 98% of the time. But
that's probably more than I do. Yeah, I go back and read some of my stuff and I'm like, did I really write that? Did I think that 2 years ago? That recent?
Well, that's part of life, though. You know, I mean, you do change your views on things, and that's what's called maturity, I guess. But hey,
yeah, every now and then I'll come across something that I wrote, and I've forgotten that I wrote it, and I'll get three sentences into an article, and I think, hey, this is interesting, and this is familiar. No, I wrote this. I write a lot, and so I sometimes forget what I've done.
I'm sure you do. Hey, listen, also, when you do get a chance, just tell your friend Charles Cook that he's got a great admirer here just north of Austin, Texas. That's why I love his articles in the National Rifle Association magazine. I love his articles in the National Review, and your podcast with him is fabulous. So thank you very much. And I understand
you're
going on vacation, so I hope you enjoy that. Well, thank you. Well, great. I'm glad you did. You know, you always step into these conversations with a bit of trepidation. You know, what if they think you're an idiot? But apparently, at least I passed the idiot test in any case. So thank you very much. I'm going to close here and say to people out there, listen up, folks out there, I hope you've all enjoyed this podcast. And remember to go to successmadetolast.com to register for our newsletter, filled with what I think at least is fun information about our future guests and some great stuff in general, I think. And go to your podcast distributor, iTunes, Spreaker, etc., and rate our show, please. Till the next time, go out there and live the best version of you.
So let me tell you a little bit about Blinkist. Blinkist is the most useful app on my phone. And it's really hard to find time to sit down and read and learn more. And when you don't have free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's this incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique. It works on my iPhone, and it can work on your tablet or web browser as well. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people, like business leaders, are well known for reading lots of books, and Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, or lunch break, or while you exercise. There's 12 million plus people using Blinkist right now, and it's got a growing library of self-help, business, health, history books. And you can go to Blinkist.com to see some of the latest titles. I like Blinkist because listening to some of the most popular books that I just haven't found time to get to, including Alexander Hamilton by Ron Chernow and Super Thinking by Gabe Weinberg. Two great books. So right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. You can go to Blinkist.com/success and try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/success to start your free 7-day trial today. Give it a shot. You will love microburst learning from Blinkist.